From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today we drop into the headquarters of the United Nations in New York City for the daily press conferences for both the Secretary General and the General Assembly's President. We begin with the spokesperson for Secretary General Antonio Guterres, Stefan Dujarric. He'll be followed by Brendan Varma, who is the spokesperson for the President of the 75th General Assembly, Volkan Bozkır.
Good afternoon. In a statement we issued, I guess almost overnight, I wanted to read into the record that the Secretary General is very encouraged by President Moon Jae-in's announcement of the Republic of Korea's commitment to get to net zero emissions by 2050. This is a very positive step in the right direction after Korea's exemplary Green New Deal, which was announced in July. With the announcement, the Republic of Korea, the world's 11th largest economy and the 6th largest exporter in the world, joins a growing group of major economies committed to lead by example in building a sustainable, carbon-neutral, and climate-resilient world by 2050. The Secretary General now looks forward to concrete policy measures that will be proposed and implemented to reach this goal. This includes the Republic of Korea submitting in time for COP26 revised 2030 nationally determined contributions, which is more ambitious and consistent with its new commitment to carbon neutrality by 2050. And yesterday afternoon, the Secretary General spoke to the Nordic Council in via live video link, saying that a new effective multilateralism is needed to provide global governance on issues that concern us all, including the climate crisis and the COVID-19 pandemic. Regarding the climate crisis, the Secretary General called on Nordic countries to submit more ambitious, nationally determined contributions under the Paris Agreement ahead of next year's COP26. He also asked them to maintain and enhance their financial commitments to support developing countries. It is my hope that members of the Nordic Council will serve as a global model for green, inclusive, and sustainable recovery, he told them. The Secretary General also commended the Nordic Council for its commitment to multilateralism and leadership on efforts to address the COVID-19 emergency in an effective way. Our Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed will be on a, quote, virtual trip to Colombia today and tomorrow. This is the first virtual country visit since the outbreak of the pandemic, and the trip will highlight the importance of Security Council Resolution 1325 on women, peace, and security, marking its 20th anniversary marking the 20th anniversary, which will be on 29th October tomorrow. The virtual visit also enables the Deputy Secretary General to witness the UN's work in Colombia, working with national and local authorities and civil society organizations, including the response to the pandemic, development challenges, and peace consolidation. She will be accompanied by Undersecretary General and Executive Director of UN Women, Fumzile Mblaku-Gukka, and Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs, Rosemary DiCarlo. Ms. Mohammed and her delegation will be meeting by video conference with various officials, including President Ivan Duque. They will also talk to women's human rights defenders, women leaders, and discuss the advances and challenges in implementing the 2016 agreement. The last time the Deputy Secretary General visited Colombia in person was 2015 for the launch of the Interinstitutional Commission for Sustainable Development Goals. Quick note on an update on Nagorno-Karabakh. As the Secretary General has stated unequivocally, we strongly condemn all attacks on populated areas impacted by conflict, including the strikes on the city of Barda, which reportedly killed and wounded many, as well as the ongoing reported shelling of Stepanakert Kakhendi and other localities in the Nagorno-Karabakh zone of conflict. There can be no justification for such attacks. We again reiterate the Secretary General's call on the parties to immediately implement the humanitarian ceasefire and that the parties have committed to and fully abide by their obligations to spare and protect civilians and civilian infrastructure. The ongoing hostilities are unacceptable and must stop immediately. And just to give you some clear examples of the humanitarian impact of this ongoing conflict, the UN Children's Fund today said that in one month of fighting, more than 130,000 people have been displaced, 76 schools and kindergartens damaged, and one maternity hospital shelled. Countless children are being scarred by the psychological impact of daily exposure to rockets and missile attacks in civilian areas. And turning to Syria, our colleagues on the ground conducted a one-day interagency visit to Idlib Governorate in the northwest of the country. Yesterday, the UN's humanitarian agencies visited a displacement camp in central Idlib, supported through funding from the Central Emergency Fund. They met with members of the displaced communities who continue to live under very difficult conditions. They also met with humanitarian personnel and local authorities and visited warehouses storing supplies for winterization and COVID-19 response in the area. Missions such as these help the UN gain a first-hand understanding of the humanitarian situation and current needs in the Northwest. Some 2.8 million people, half of them children, remain in need of humanitarian assistance in the Northwest. The UN's humanitarian cross-border assistance provides a lifeline for millions in this area for whom the UN cannot reach by any other means. This was just handed to me just to note that we strongly condemn the attack on a religious school in Peshawar yesterday that reportedly killed at least 8 students and injured more than 100 people, some of whom were children and teachers. The Secretary General conveys his condolences to the families of the victims and the people of government of Pakistan. And a quick update from Somalia, which continues to be one of the most complex, fragile, and protracted humanitarian situations in the world. Our humanitarian colleagues report that 5.2 million people are in need of humanitarian assistance through 2021 due to the impact of the current climactic shocks, armed conflict, insecurity, displacements, and the pandemic. Flooding this area this year has impacted nearly 1.6 million people, destroyed farmlands and infrastructure, and increased the risk of waterborne diseases. In addition, desert locust infestation since January has impacted 685,000 people. The number of people facing food insecurity is expected to rise from 1.3 million in September to about 2.1 million through December. In the absence of humanitarian assistance. We, along with our partners, have reached over 2.3 million people with aid this year, while 61% of the $1 billion humanitarian response plan has been received to date. That's about $618 million. Funding per sector remains disproportionate, with more than half of the clusters receiving less than 35% of required funding. And an update from Cabo Verde, where resident coordinator Ana Patricia Grassa is leading the UN's team's work in supporting the government's response to the pandemic. Our team has reprogrammed 17 million funds previously geared for work on sustainable development. It has mobilized an additional 4 million to support national efforts to save lives and livelihoods. Through a crisis response coordination platform set up with the government, we have provided support for socioeconomic impact assessment in partnership with the World Bank, the African Development Bank, and the European Union. Through the COVID-19 data portal, our team is also reporting on the socioeconomic impact of the crisis in Cabo Verde, focusing on vulnerable communities. This includes the provisions of vaccines to more than 7,000 children under 1 year of age, assistance to more than 700,000 health workers, and remote learning access to more than 66,000 children. Meals are also being provided to more than 26,000 primary school children. 100,000 people are receiving cash assistance, and 14,000 small businesses have access to support programs. You can check out more data on the UN team in Cabo Verde and our work in other countries on the Development Coordination's COVID-19 data portal, data.uninfo.org. And just lastly, I want to flag a new report by FAO that warns that unless we restore the world's forests and that those efforts are scaled up, we will not be able to achieve the SDGs by 2030. To date, 63 countries and other entities have committed to restoring 173 million hectares of forest land. That's about half of the size of India, and region responses such as the African Forest Landscape Restoration Initiative and Initiative 20 by 20 in Latin America are making significant advances, yet much more needs to be done. James.
Yeah, can we have an update, please, on, given that the UN in-person meetings are closed, we believe, until Friday, on the cases of COVID in the UN and in the mission of Niger?
Sure. The cases that I have as of today for the UN-wide is 5,325 cases. We've sadly had 64 fatalities. In the Secretariat here in New York, we had about 130 cases. I'm still not in a position to confirm which mission was at the center of this particular reporting, though I can tell you, as I did yesterday, that they are working very closely with our medical service. As you said, the meetings, the Secretary General recommended to the President of General Assembly that meetings be held in person through the end of the week. We hope to get back to normal very soon.
Why can you not confirm the name of the mission? You said yesterday you hope to be able to confirm the name of the mission. Shortly they'd make a statement.
They have not
made a statement. Just because they're covering up, why should the UN cover up? The Secretary General himself said in April, more than ever, governments must be transparent, responsive, and accountable.
I understand it is.
Why are you taking part in covering this up?
I'm not
it's
covering,
facts and it's
no,
public
no, I,
health.
I understand that. It is up to them to come forward.
They are... Council, Niger, for the record, Niger, which you won't say. What are there tests being done on people who went to Security Council meetings?
Yes,
the
full contact tracing is being
done. Just explain how that works. I mean, is the UN responsible for taking a register of who was in each room at one time? Is the UN asking people? Is the UN conducting tests?
Yes,
is it providing its medical service to do so?
We are as. Contact tracing. I mean, there's a basic procedure for people to report the contacts they've had. We then contact those people. We are offering tests through our medical service to those delegates who want to avail themselves of our facilities, and others can do their own tests.
Sorry, but you still haven't quite explained to me how the contact tracing works. People have to report if they had a contact. If they were listening to you, they wouldn't know it was a Niger diplomat that they should know that they have a contact with. And does the UN, for meetings in the GA, in the committees, in the Security Council and ECOSOC, keep a record of which diplomats were in the room at which time with which other diplomats? Or are you relying only on those diplomats to remember who might have been in the room?
No, we know. I mean, there are records. I will have to double check. My understanding is that there are record, you know, especially given that there are very few people in the meeting rooms, that we know who was in the meeting rooms. Sherwin.
Just to follow up on sort of the track that James is on, have the HVAC systems in the building been improved? Can you talk a little bit about what sort of
mitigation? Yes, they were. There was a lot of work done over the summer on improving the air filtration system, putting them up to. The necessary level that have been recommended by the host authorities. My understanding of HVAC systems is slightly higher than my understanding of escalators. But what I can tell you is, from my understanding, the air filtration system in the conference building is separate than the air filtration system in the secretariat building. Okay, Edie, and I'll come back to you, James.
Sorry, Steph. Two questions. First, a follow-up on James and Sherwin. Have you contacted the mission in question and urged them to put out a statement on the status of COVID-19 in their mission?
Yes, I've been in touch with them directly, and I would add that they are the ones who came forward to the Secretariat to say that they had a number of cases.
And since you were in contact with them, what was their response? That they were planning to put out a statement?
Yes, I mean, I don't want to speak for them, but that was the understanding that I had.
Okay, my question was on the presidential election in Tanzania. I know the Secretary General put out a statement mm-hmm. ahead of the election. The opposition today is warning that the election is being compromised by manipulation, deadly violence, and a massive internet slowdown. Any further comment? And then I have one other.
Look, just to add that we do hope that the elections take place in a way that all Tanzanians are able to express their position through the ballot box, that there is a space created for people to express to vote in the proper manner. And that if there are any issues with the results, that those be taken up through the established means. And, of course, a call to ensure that there is no violence, no instigation to violence through hate speech.
And another follow-up on COVID. Has the Secretary General been in contact with all other missions, and have there been any other reports?
No other reports that have come to us of other. Mr. Bayes, and then we'll go to the screen for a bit.
That was going to be part of my question, but is there an obligation? One assumes under simple contact tracing, there is an obligation of all missions to report any cases. Are you saying all missions should report any cases of COVID to the UN medical?
Obligation is given, as you understand the structure of the UN. An obligation is a strong word. We strongly encourage all member states, all permanent missions, to proactively report to us any positive cases. And I have to say that we've had very good cooperation on that end.
Well, you think you have, because you don't know whether you've got the right number of cases. So if that is the case, then you provided some useful statistics for us for this briefing. Could you by tomorrow come up with how many cases there have been in the 193 missions since the start of the pandemic, please?
There have been, as of earlier this week, there were 5 cases amongst the delegates. So this does not include what the exact number of cases had this week. But let me just, I will double check because I actually asked for that information.
Seems very low.
Well, you know, it's, so the cases, the 100 and, yeah, so the 130 cases as of today. I had 127. This was as of earlier this week. The breakdown was 2 consultants, 5 delegates, 16 dependents, 45 international staff, 47 national staff, one trainee, and 7 unclear what their status was. So the majority of cases, I mean the largest group of cases have been with international staff and national staff reported to us. I'll come back to you. Let me go to the screen. Abdelhamid, I think you've been waving your hand. And then Toby. Yes.
Thank you, Stefan. First, I have a follow-up to my question yesterday about Mohammed Assaf being prevented from going back to the West Bank. That's a follow-up question yesterday.
Yes, so I don't have an. I apologize. I don't have an update for you on that.
And my second question, or my question for the day, is about Mladenov briefing to the Security Council on Monday. He requested the PA to resume security and civilian coordination with Israel, which is a fact that he ignoring the reasons for this suspension, because Israel decided to annex 30% of the West Bank and build more settlement, which Israel is doing as we speak. Why he failed also to call on Israel to lift 13 years of siege on Gaza, instead of asking the PA to resume coordinate security coordination with Israel?
I think his remarks were a broad reflection of the consistent positions we have had and the consistent calls we have had from the Secretary General in calling for dialogue, in ensuring that humanitarian aid and goods and people are able to flow freely. I don't see any of his remarks as a change in our basic principles. Toby.
Hi, Steph. Thanks very much. We're seeing a potential dangerous escalation in the fighting in Syria between Turkish-backed forces and Russian warplanes. I'm hoping you can give us an update on what you're seeing from the UN side on that. And my second question is on, again, on the Tanzania elections. Opposition reporting that there's a very large police presence on the ground in Zanzibar, which could be perceived as an intimidation tactic. Are you seeing a similar phenomenon, and what do you think about that? Thank you.
You know, I've unfortunately did not get an update from the ground today. Our concern, obviously, is, and I think the Secretary General expressed that very clearly in his statement, is that the elections go ahead in an atmosphere of calm, free of fear and intimidation, and where everyone can cast their ballots. Let's let the day go through. On Syria, I have no particular information on those clashes. But again, I think, as Mr. Pedersen said, you know, we have been concerned at some of the military operations, and all of these continued clashes only have a negative impact on the overall humanitarian situation. Mr. Klein, and then Philippe.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Joe.
Okay, thank you. As you know, the President of the General Assembly had tried to set up a person-to-person meeting with New York City Mayor de Blasio, and he was turned down. He also has a request in for a meeting with Governor Cuomo, mainly focused on the coronavirus and protocol for handling it in the UN's host city. Has the Secretary General himself tried to reach out to either de Blasio or Cuomo, let's say within the last number of months?
We are, from the Secretariat point of view, we have been in constant contact, especially on the health and the safety issues, with the with our partners in New York City and in New York State. And I think the operational contact has been almost daily. And we also remain in we have been in touch with the people we needed to be in touch with to ensure that the UN's work can continue and that the UN can continue to be a good neighbor to New York City and New York State.
Does the Secretary General have any comment on what happened to the President of the General Assembly?
He does not. He does not. Philippe.
Yes, hello, Stefan. I would like to come back to this virtual visit you talk about, Colombian Sis Mohamed. Is it a first, this kind of virtual visit for an official of UN? And can you tell us if Antonio Gutierrez is planning to do this kind of virtual visit in a country, and if yes, where and when? Thank you.
No plans to announce on the Secretary General. It is the first virtual visit by the Deputy Secretary General. Perhaps others in the UN system have done so, but I think it is a very effective way, given the travel challenges that we have, for us to, and for a senior official to engage with national authorities, with local NGOs, civil society, and the UN team. Carla.
Thank you. Last week, when I believe it was Toby asked the question whether you were aware of any attempts, any pressures being put on the countries which were ratifying the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. And then again yesterday, I don't remember whether Mr. Sato raised the issue, but it turns out that, in fact, the whole story was broken by one of my most distinguished colleagues, so it's now in the public domain. So does the UN have any comment upon an attempt by a nuclear weapons state to sabotage the entry into force of this treaty? You sent out to us a quote from the Secretary General saying the treaty represents the meaningful commitment toward the total elimination of nuclear weapons, which remains the highest disarmament priority of the United Nations. So if a nuclear weapons state...
Look, I have no way of knowing what member states say to each other. And the Secretary General has always called for a dialogue among member states to come up with a common vision and a path leading to the total elimination of nuclear weapons. And he will continue to, and the Secretary General continues to support engagement between those who support the treaty and those who have issues with it. Alan Brucati.
Thank you, Stefan. today, the National Security Advisor, Mr. Robert O'Brien, made a harsh statement. He said that the United States are developing ballistic missiles and the hypersonic missiles and are ready to deploy them in Europe to deter Russian Federation. I wonder, I want to ask you, how do you think... What kind of circumstances could this, to the security in Europe, could such a statement have?
Alan, to be honest with you, I have not seen the statement, so I will take a look at it and try to come back to you. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Mr. Sato, please.
Yeah, thank you, Stefan. My question is about climate change. We know the ranking of the carbon dioxide emitter, the China, U.S., India, Russia, and Japan, and so on. And recently, Japan announced the neutrality, emission neutrality at 2050, followed by the South Korea yesterday. What does Secretary General expect from other largest emitter, such as U.S., India, and Russia?
Look, we think the announcement made by yesterday by the President of the Republic of Korea, the announcement made earlier this week by the Prime Minister of Japan, were very, very strong steps in the right direction, which the Secretary General welcomed. And he hopes that these countries that are leading by example will encourage others, especially the largest emitters, to follow suit. Okay, Varma, yours.
Good afternoon. Yesterday evening, the President wrote a second letter to the membership in connection with the five COVID-19 infections at a mission of a member state. He noted that he had received a letter from the Secretary General recommending that in-person meetings be suspended until the end of the week in order to allow for a better understanding of the extent of the exposure and for full contact tracing to be completed. Accordingly, after consulting with the chairs of the main committees and to safeguard public health, all in-person meetings of the plenary and main committees of the General Assembly are canceled this week. The General Assembly plenary was supposed to hold two meetings this week. It was to consider the report of the International Court of Justice tomorrow and the report of the Human Rights Council on Friday. Those meetings are now postponed. The first committee, which covers disarmament, was supposed to vote on all resolutions this week in person. The fourth committee, on Special Political and Decolonization Committee, also had plans to meet in person. Those two committees have therefore had to postpone their work this week. The second committee, which handles economic and financial matters, and the third committee, which covers social, humanitarian, and cultural issues, had originally been planning to work virtually this week, so their work is unaffected. The sixth committee, or legal committee, will continue to hold virtual negotiations as originally planned, and its bureau will meet this afternoon to reschedule their canceled in-person meetings. Philippe, is that your hand up?
Yes, Thank you, Brendan. Can you tell us what is the status of the draft resolution on the COVID summit in December? When do you expect a vote of you?
Sure. Silence was broken on that draft.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.